Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Welcome to Unified. This is a show where we listen, learn, laugh, and unify across our differences. We meet people from different and diverse backgrounds all over Ireland and hear their stories and perspectives. I'm your host, Momobo Ogoro, and you can get in touch with us on Unified by emailing unified@newstalk.com. That's Unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, how should the film industry approach diversity in casting? We'll be talking about that with our panel. We'll meet the new leader of Belong to Youth Services on What's Your Story? And on Social Scene, we'll be celebrating Brazilian Day. But first, who gets to be seen on screen and who gets left out from a story? Conversations around diversity in castings continues to be a challenge in the film industry. Is casting about finding the best actor for the role, or does the industry also have a responsibility to reflect on their own practices and when it comes to diversity of the audiences watching as well? So today on Unified, we're going to be asking that very question. How should the film industry approach diversity in casting? And joining me today for that conversation is producer Grace Odomosu and film director and curator Aisha Bolaji. We'll be exploring representation, authenticity, opportunity, and whether the industry is moving beyond the conversation about diversity towards meaningful change. Welcome, ladies. Before we get into the meat of the conversation, I know there's a lot of Lord of the Rings fans listening here, and many of them know that the new film, The Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum, is coming out. And there was something kind of controversial that the director, Andy Serkis, said regarding diversity in casting. And we're just going to play that before we get into the conversation.
Tolkien himself was influenced a lot by Norse mythology. There's a lot of kind of that feeling. The Shire feels very, very much like a very white, you know, they're not very concerned about what goes on beyond the borders of the Shire, but they know they don't want people coming in. Yes, there have been criticisms. This particular film is somewhat acknowledging that. I don't think we're doing a sort of, we will be doing a politically correct, just casting for the sake of casting and ticking boxes version of the film. So it's where relevant, basically.
My first question to you all is, like, what is your opinions on all that? Grace, can I start with you?
Like, in some ways, I totally get what he's saying. We don't want to just be a tick box. It, you know, we don't want it to be like, oh, we're just going to have one. So therefore, look what we've done. We've put in this brown person. Cool, cool, cool. But at the same time, this is a fantasy film. This is the one space where, you know, audiences can expend their belief and accept a black or brown elf or whatever it might be, because it's fantasy. It can be, you know, it's supposed to be a world that's created. It's not supposed to be reality. It's not supposed to be real world. So in that way, I'm like, it's not okay.
And Aisha, what are your thoughts?
I think I'd kind of be echoing what Grace is saying. Like, it is like a very, like, The Lord of the Rings is like a fantasy, like, franchise. And I think you don't want to then, like, limit yourself to the talent that you have access to for the sake of, like, oh, we don't want to seem to be, like, ticking boxes or doing anything like that. And I'd understand, like, if they were casting, like, a wider net, but, like, obviously I don't know what that casting process was, but it doesn't seem like they were. And I think that is playing it rather safe as well. And I don't think that always leads to, like, the most interesting choices being made, even from, like, just a filmmaking point of view.
And when you say interesting choices, what do you mean by that?
I think, like, for example, like, when you look at, like, House of the Dragon and the Valyrians, they casted black actors and, like, cast a black family to play that lineage. And, like, even though, like, you wouldn't necessarily say, like, oh, that's book accurate, it added, like, extra layers to the story as well. And, like, I guess, like, those were the people cast in those roles were also just very talented actors too. Like, it wasn't a case of, like, oh, like, you know, we're gonna, like, by casting black or brown actors, we're gonna have, like, a lesser quality. Because I think that's something else that tends to come up in the conversation, not just in casting, but, like, when it comes to, like, hiring and, like, the job sphere in general, that when you, I guess, like, hire more diverse people, then you're suddenly not hiring based off merit. But I don't think that's true. I think everyone still needs to show up and do a really good job. And I don't think it, like, for the most part, depending on what your story is, it shouldn't hinder the story. And obviously sometimes like you need specific racial things that need to be in place because the story calls for it. But when it comes into the realms of fantasy, like Grace said, people can expend their disbelief or it can be like an extra added layer.
And I suppose like that piece when you said in terms of merit and this idea of like, okay, we're just casting in the context of fantasy, we're just casting for diversity or we're just casting for to tick the box, like you said, when there's perceptions that, okay, this person just got this job because they were black or they were disabled or they were neurodivergent or whatever. What would you say to that, Grace, in terms of like when they're trying to diversify casting and they do cast in a certain way and then there's this kind of uproar because of the diversified casts?
It's a hard one because we want to diversify the cast. We don't just want to be a tick box, but people often will kind of look at that as, you know, especially if it's just the one, that becomes, I guess, an issue. It becomes something that we look like that the world or society looks at as just a tick box. So I guess it's, for me, it's about like opening it up even more. And it's not just about the one, it's about finding the right person for this. But in the context of like, we can't just keep going with, you know, the right people are white. We have to open our minds and we have to open, you know, the creativity and create these roles for black and brown actors.
And that's important to create these roles. But are you saying that we need to create specific roles for them or... What are you saying?
It's a bit of a mix. Okay, so it's a mixed bag because for me, I'm like, I started out in the industry as an actor. I'm a producer now because I wanted to create the roles for black and brown actors in Ireland that weren't created for me back when I started acting. But even now, I still get, you know, certain casting directors will still send me some things to tape for. And every single time I get something from them, it's ethnicity any. And like, that might sound like, that's really cool. At least they're like really open, you know? And in ways it's like, yeah, cool. I like that you're trying to like open your pool. But where's the ethnicity specific, you know? So that's one side of it, you know? I'd love to get a role in that says ethnicity, mixed race Irish or ethnicity Irish Nigerian, because that's a very specific way that, you know, that person experiences the world, that person walks through the world, that person, you know, goes down the street, that person interacts with other white people, that person interacts with black people. Like, it's very specific. So that's like, you know, something that's quite thought out of. When you say like ethnicity any, it just feels a bit too broad for me. But in a world where the majority of roles are going to white people, in ways I don't want to complain about ethnicity any because I don't want them to take away, you know, that ability to give black and brown actors the option and the place to audition, because sometimes it's just like, oh, we found one, you know, black or brown actor and they're fantastic and we're going to cast them because it was an ethnicity any.
And when you say like, you want the ethnicities to be specific, and because of that lived experience or because of the different ways of seeing the world, I suppose, like, I mean, I'm being the devil's advocate here. I suppose like for the director or the person creating it that has this ideal of how they want a character to kind of experience the world. Do you think that, and this is to you, Aisha, do you think that lived experience is important for specific roles if we make it specific or if we make it for any, if you get what I mean?
I think like lived experience is important for specific roles. But I think that being said, when it comes to, I guess, like storytelling and things like that, and like this is more of a like, I guess, behind the camera sort of thing, it gets kind of like, I guess like it gets a bit iffy because you're looking at writers who don't want to just be limited to telling one kind of story if you've lived a very specific kind of life. And I think that's what's so great about film is that it is so collaborative that you can have like, you know, you can co-write, you can bring on like story consultants, you can bring on cultural consultants, like you can make things with like intention. But I think sometimes like those systems can also get like quite exploited and people might not get like, you know, compensated for their time for going out of their way and like giving guess, like, for example, giving their lived experiences, like what it means to be like a refugee in Ireland or something like that. But in terms of like in front of the camera, I think, honestly, I think it comes down to the role. Because I know, for example, like in the Odyssey, they had like Lupita Nyong'o playing Helen of Troy. And it's like, well, she hasn't had a lived experience being Helen of Troy. Mm-hmm. Or like even like you have, I think Benedict Cumberbatch played like a dragon or something. He's never been a dragon, you know?
Yep.
So it's just that thing of like actors also deserve like room to play, and like, you know, play pretend is such a big part of it. That I'm like,
but can they play mm-hmm. a specific identity? So like a dragon is fantasy.
Yeah.
But then when you have, for example, I'm thinking of the movie Obsession. The lead, he was a gay man playing a straight man. Do you get what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't that much uproar. But if it's a gay character not playing a gay character,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
there would be a bit more controversy.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that? Like, yes, for a fantasy, we can play. But when it comes to identity, there's much, it's a bit more touchy.
I think specifically with sexuality, because you can't assume. And I think there's been a lot of actors, like I think of like Kit Connor and how he was essentially like pushed to come out as bisexual because he was playing a bisexual character on Heartstopper. And that shouldn't have happened. Like it's not, obviously people should be out and proud, but that's also a very like personal thing. And I think like it also creates this thing of like, oh, sexuality looks a certain way and the way people carry themselves. So I think specifically when it comes to playing queer characters, yes, it's great if it can be like those roles can be like, you know, like taken by queer actors. But at the same time, like a lot of people aren't out. A lot of people find it dangerous to come out, or even like there's still backlash, particularly for like the trans community and things like that. So I wouldn't want to, when it comes to like gender identity and like queerness and things like that, I think that's where it's like, I guess like more of a mixed bag in terms of what you can portray. But then, for example, when it comes to race, obviously you've like, you know, people always make that joke of like, oh, we'll get Ryan Gosling to play Martin Luther King. But it's kind of...
Who said that?
Yeah, I want to know who said that joke.
Yeah, it's like anytime, because like, I think it was like during like the casting of like The Little Mermaid.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they had Halle Bailey playing The Little Mermaid. And like, you know, she had red locks in. So she was still representing the redheaded community. But I don't think that was enough for some people. Because they're kind of like, oh, like, you know, but like for her, like being white wasn't specific to the story.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't necessarily add to it or take away from it that she wasn't fair skinned and that she wasn't like white, you know. But like, for example, if you're dealing with like a real life person of Martin Luther King, and if you made him white, then it's like, oh, that actually does take away from the story. So for some stories, I'm like, yeah, like it is a specificity there for race. But for others, I'm like, there really isn't. And it just depends on like, I guess, what way the director wants to go about it and how open they are.
It's also kind of about the stories that we're telling at the moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like the more we get away from telling, you know, the racialized stories about racism, the more we get to accept that we can just tell stories about black and brown people, and therefore black and brown actors will be accepted in any kind of specific, not specific role, you know, like that, like the Little Mermaid, it being black, or it doesn't take away from the Little Mermaid's story. It's just a story about a little mermaid, and this mermaid happens to be black.
It makes sense. Like, but I was thinking for like when people have like long-standing depictions or ideas,
mm-hmm.
that Little Mermaid piece was a very unique story, because when people have very long-standing depictions or ideas around a certain character, especially the way the character looks, people can feel a bit betrayed when they mm-hmm. change the way the character mm-hmm. looks. So it's I hear you in terms of like, okay, it's a story not about ethnicity and race, and people need to be open about it. But I think people may have like an affiliation, let's say, with this, how the way a certain character looks, and it hurts their feelings, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to casting specifically, what are your thoughts on, we've talked about like in front of the camera, but behind the camera, and in terms of a, like a diversified crew as well, what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I'm dying to be on a crew that is fully diversified. Mm-hmm. Every time that I produce something, I try my hardest to engage a diverse crew, whether that be LGBTQ+, black and brown, you know, in general, diverse races, people who with accessibility needs and stuff like that. But it's so, so hard. And it's also, you're battling with not just, like, it's my idea, in my mind, I want a diverse crew. But then we have whoever our director is, and say that person isn't of a diverse background, they have the specific person that they want to work with. Mm. And it's just like this, the way that our film industry is structured is very much like this person picks this person, picks this person, picks this person. And it just kind of has a knock-on effect. So I might have a fantastic second AC who's, you know, black, but our DOP already has a team of people that they're used to working with, and they have a shorthand. And so there's lots of things that come along with that. So it's just like there's so many structures that are built into the industry that are fighting against completely diversifying our crews that, you know, and that's not to say that I'm going to stop fighting for it. Mm-hmm. I still will. Every time I do something new, it's like I bring along the people that, you know, the last thing that I worked with, I found a new hair person who was black. Mm-hmm. And so anytime that I'm trying to do something, I'm trying to bring her along. And yeah, it's just, it's a structural thing that, unfortunately, we're just constantly battling.
And I suppose for an industry that relies on like the gig economy, freelancers, it's much more easier to work with people that you've worked with, being consciously or unconsciously aware that they're like all the same, I guess. And I suppose like what, and I've been reading especially about the Casting Directors Guild of Great Britain and Ireland, and they were saying in terms of their policy, in terms of diversity and inclusion on casting, that their aim for the industry is to cast consciously, whether that is the people that we have on screen or off screen. That conscious casting, in my opinion, without any underlying enforcement, can be quite hard to do, like you said, because it's usually the people that are deconstructing, unlearning and relearning themselves are the ones that are doing the work. But oftentimes it's a minority of people. Aisha, what would you say for anybody that wants to start casting consciously? What do they need to start do, or what do we need to start doing as an industry to ensure that, whether it's the crew or people on screen, how do we ensure that that diversity and intersectionality is there?
I guess like accessibility comes to mind. Like how do you like reach these communities? Because I know for a lot of the time, like let's say like a casting call out might go up on like Instagram, and like, you know, you have the same kind of like Instagram followers that you've always had. It might be worth like, you know, going down to like, I don't know, like wherever like the local African church is and like putting in posters there, or like, you know, kind of taking the extra step to meet people where they are. Because I think a lot of the time they're like, oh, they're just not there. But it's like, you're not actually searching for them. Like you're not, because like if you've already established a space that has not been like accessible to them in the past, why would they now just suddenly show up out of nowhere?
Literally.
You know, so you have to like go meet people where they are, or even like, you know, with like working class communities and things like that, like you have to like go to those communities, because there's already like an element of distrust from the way the industry has functioned before, whether like subconsciously or consciously, that it's like you need to like go build those relationships, like you need to go build those networks, you need to like go out to those places, go out to those schools, wherever it is, and actually like just build from the ground up rather than expecting people to find you. Because I think it's like it is quite lazy to kind of use the same system that you've always used and expect a different outcome.
Yeah, this has been a closed door situation for many, many years. Now, obviously, now we're seeing a lot more diverse casting and stuff like that in our TV shows here in Ireland than, say, there was 20 years ago when I came out of acting school and was trying to get roles. But it's still not far enough along. But like you were just saying, it's about going to those places and opening those doors, because the doors have been closed for so many years that like people that don't know that that we're trying to diversify the industry, that we're trying to create these roles, don't feel like this is a place for them. They don't feel like they can step through the doors. So it's about making intentional, conscious effort to find these people and not just saying, oh, we put out a call and nobody came back, or, oh, you know, the applications just weren't there. Like, that's just not an acceptable enough, you know, thing to say in this day and age. Like, if you want to diversify this industry, you will make an effort to go out there and find these people. Because do you know what that does when you do that? That brings you the diamonds in the rough. That brings you the people who have that creativity in their soul that they just need somebody to say, do this thing, or here's this script, read this and record for me, or read this and come back to me. And you will find so many amazing, beautiful people who don't necessarily have, you know, the official training, or who haven't gone through the industry because they've maybe felt it wasn't a place for them. When I was casting for a short there a couple of years ago, we were looking for a mixed race young girl, and we got like, there's maybe five of the age range that are currently like working regularly in the industry, and we got tapes from all of them and they were all great. And then we got this one tape from this one girl who had never done anything before, and it was so true and so real and felt so sincere that I instantly was like, that's our girl, that's who it is. And of course then I was like battling with other people being like, oh, but this person's well known and this person's done this and this person's done that, and that will serve the short and all that. And eventually it just had to come down to, but this person who's never done anything before is the right person for this role. And how will she ever do anything if everyone just keeps saying she's never done anything before? She's got no official training, but she's actually a fantastic actor. So let's give her a chance.
It's kind of like the chicken and egg situation when it comes to the work experience versus doing the thing and providing that opportunity for people to do that. Of course, when there's like, if it's crew and technical, people need training on cameras and all that kind of stuff for the technical pieces. But for the acting and your story, sometimes just people need that opportunity or that leg up. And it really requires, especially for underrepresented communities, it requires a lot of trust. And what I was hearing from both of you is that those who are casting, those who are making those decisions, they need to do the work. When you're in a position of power or privilege of any sort, it's often, you're often the first to be like, oh, it didn't work, oh, that didn't happen. But it's, you are the one that has the onus to do the work of reaching out. You have the onus to do the work of building the trust and putting your hand out. So it's great to hear that that is there. And once you build the trust, how can we avoid or get into that space where we're not like tokenizing the person or stereotyping? Because that's one of the fears
or
that I hear.
Or using the same kind of five people or whatever.
Or we're using this person or making the person feel like they're being used as like, okay, we have a black person, now we're done, it's fine. What would you say to that?
I mean, that's a really hard one, because again, that's something that when I came out of acting college in 2009, it was very, very hard. And every time I was met with something, it was like, oh no, we have Ruth Naga, so we don't need another mixed race person to be an actor. And so to still be having this conversation almost 20 years later, like, come on, the industry needs to change. People need to start actually making the change, or people need to start actually consciously making decisions to open up and to go out there and do the work. It's not enough to just say, oh, I'm doing the work, or, oh, I tried this thing, or, oh, I cast this one person in this one thing. It's a consistent thing that we need to keep doing.
And it's a lot of effort.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. It's a lot of effort. But when you have, I always describe any sort of equity-based work kind of like, do you know those escalators in the airport and the ones that go slow that are flat. So any sort of equity work is kind of like standing still on one of those escalators. When you're not doing it, it's just easy to flow with what's already going on and the simple systems. But when you're actually trying to consciously make an industry better it's literally like walking in the opposite direction. And when there isn't policies in place, when there isn't an overarching governing system, when you're relying on a gig economy, it's much more harder to walk in the opposite direction to ensure the equity or to ensure the diversity of an industry. So just props to both of you for actually putting that thing forward. And what would you say, Aisha, to any sort of person that is listening, they're coming from a minoritized background, they're looking to start engaging with the industry, they're being faced with no's, yes, or things like that, they're feeling stereotyped. What would you say to that kind of person that is trying to build their career with the talent that they have, but also the intersectional identities that they hold?
I think honestly, like, it's very important to stay like very true to yourself and stay true to your story. I think I hear a lot about like other writer directors who felt like they've been pigeonholed into like telling a very specific type of story because they're Black, and like it does become a little harder when I guess you operate outside of that. But I also don't think it's worth going into telling stories that you're not passionate about. Because like no one, it's like, I think the film industry, like I don't know anyone who's had like an easy time in the industry. I think that's always a given. But it's like, if you really want to like, you know, make it in the industry, if you really want to put your best foot forward, you can only do that by telling stories that you truly believe in, even though it might be harder. But I guess on like the more like practical element of it, like the more like, I guess like the more money side of it, it's kind of like, oh, you might have to do jobs that like you don't, I guess like you don't know, like you're not 100% like in it, but it's kind of like, okay, just make sure you have like clear boundaries like drawn for yourself. Like make sure like you know where the line is. And then also like, you know, like once you start writing, you're a writer, like once you start, you know, taping like monologues or whatever it is, you're an actor. I think like, don't be afraid to just like show up and tell people, I'm a writer, I'm a director, I'm an actor. Because I think a lot of, I hate using the word aspiring. I think it's silly.
Yeah.
I think you can just show up as it is.
And like, be.
Yeah, 100%. And just be, like, embody that role. Because I feel like that is also how, like, opportunities come your way. Because, like, no one will know unless you kind of, like, announce it. And, like, to just kind of, like, keep putting yourself out there and, like, keep trying to, like, build, like, you know, build your networks. Like, it's not all about, like, oh, I need to find, you know, the head of A24. Or you could just find a friend who has a camera and you guys can start shooting stuff and, like, start making proofs of concepts or doing small scenes and stuff like that. Because those things really do add up. And, like, I think especially in this very, like, online era, like, there's a lot you can do to, like, build for yourself that isn't necessarily through the more traditional structures.
Just to add one more thing to that, it's about finding your people. Mm. Like how you kind of ended what you were just saying there, Aisha, is exactly what I was thinking. Find the people who want to tell the same stories that you want, who respect you, who are not just trying to tokenize you, who are not just using you. Find those people, and because we're out there.
That's a great way to round up the conversation. Thank you so much, Grace Odemosu and Aisha Boladi, for joining and sharing your perspectives and insights on this very topic. Up next, we'll meet the new CEO of Belong to Youth Services on What's Your Story? Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. So many of you know that I'm a queer person. I've grew up in Ireland as a queer person, and I didn't really know the services that existed as a queer person, young queer adult, finding themselves in Ireland. And that experience really resulted in loneliness, isolation, finding my sense of self and belonging and uncertainty. And I didn't know that there were services that actually existed to support young people in Ireland. And one of those services that existed and still exists to this day is Belong to Youth Services. They're an organization that support young LGBTQ plus adults in navigating all these uncertainties. So today on What's Your Story, I'm going to be hearing from the new CEO, Kieran O'Donovan. We'll be hearing about his experience and how he landed this role, coming from a young queer adult in Cork to now a CEO of a national youth service in Ireland. Welcome, Kieran.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Now, Kieran, you were raised in Bandon, County Cork, and I'd just love to hear more about your experience growing up in that area in Ireland.
Yes, rural West Cork. I'm a very proud Cork person. It was a great childhood. I mean, I'm very proud of my rural roots, and I've been living in Dublin nearly 20 years now, but I still go home really regularly, and it's just a place that I really, really love. And I was lucky to grow up in, you know, a relatively big, busy town, but also a very small kind of tight community. And it was, you know, the usual childhood, I think, for somebody growing up in the 80s and 90s. And it was a very safe space and a really positive space. But I suppose in the context of what we're talking about today, certainly there were challenges, challenges that still exist today in 2026, but challenges that were there, I think, for a lot of young people from my generation and my age. I was born in 1983. It really wasn't that long ago. And in 1983, homosexuality was illegal in this country and decriminalisation happened in 1993. I was 10 in 1993. I remember everything from 1993 and I remember, you know, different aspects of school and different friends that you had and stuff. So it is within my memory. And I think it's important to remind ourselves of that when we look at, you know, LGBTQ plus young people growing up in those areas at that time. And, you know, sure, at that age, I didn't really have a full understanding of it. And I don't remember any news stories about it being about homosexuality being decriminalised. But I know in retrospect that it was happening at the time. But, you know, growing up in a town like that, in a community like that, where, you know, I come from a family business and, you know, in the middle of the town and we were, you know, everybody knows you and everybody knows your name. But it was somewhere that I really thrived in. And I went to school in an all-boys secondary school and an all-boys primary school as well, actually. And when I say that to people, sometimes they immediately say, oh, is that difficult as a young LGBTQ plus young person? And really it wasn't, because, you know, you're a kid and you've got your gang and you've got your buddies and you've got your friends. So it doesn't really, nothing else really mattered beyond that. And young people and kids, certainly at the time, were very fair-minded. But I do realise that I was very lucky, because certainly the young people and the service users that we have belonged to do not report the same thing for schools in 2026. And I think now that we are more aware and that we've got that, you know, we are decriminalized for, you know, 33 years now at this stage, we do need to be more aware of young people today and how they're getting on in school. And school for them is challenging.
And you would think, like, going from the 80s to 2026, there would be a change in attitudes regarding LGBTQ plus rights, regarding homosexuality, regarding just people loving who they want to love. But like when I'm hearing from you in terms of the young people that belong to serve, is that some of those attitudes haven't changed. What are some challenges that the young people have?
There has been a change in attitudes in some ways. But if we look at the marriage referendum in 2015, people always refer to that. That was 11 years ago now. You know, some of the young people that we have coming into our groups, and I attended a group only a couple of weeks ago, and one of the young men that were in there, an LGBTQ plus young person, we were talking about the marriage referendum. We were talking about pride, and I brought it up. And firstly, he looked at me as if I was ancient, because, you know, 11 years ago was so long ago. But when I dug into it with him, he was 4 when the marriage referendum passed. He doesn't remember the day, the joy, the excitement, and how accepted the LGBTQ plus community felt in Ireland on that day. He just, the positive thing is that he thinks, yes, of course I can get married regardless of my sexuality and my gender. That's a positive thing, but he also sees a lot of issues online. He sees constant online hate. He sees right-wing conversation going on that really is actually challenging that LGBTQ plus young people even exist. You know, the online world since 2015 has changed massively. The online world did not exist when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s. Digitalization, online, the internet has brought such positive things to the community, to the world, to our country, etc. But I do think that there's an aspect of being privileged that I grew up in a place without mobile phones and without social media. I'm not going to look back going, oh, you know, we were out running around in our bare feet and we were out all day having wonderful times. You know, young people are still very involved with the community. They're involved in our youth groups. They're involved in amazing things in school and summer camps, in GA and Feroiga and Scouts and all those amazing organisations. But the phone and the social media aspect is really, really difficult. It is a difficult space for all people, but especially for young people. And I think we are seeing the negative aspects of that today in people's attention spans, in their level of anxiety, in you know, spikes in level of depression of young people, not only LGBTQ plus young people, but we do have research from being LGBT in Ireland in 2024. So really quite recent research that shows that LGBTQ plus young people are 3 times more likely to experience severe depression and anxiety than their non-LGBTQ plus peers. And that really starkly shows that the online space, social media, is affecting LGBTQ plus young people much more than it is their peers.
That's quite stark information, and something really hard for a lot of people to sit with, that because not only are they more susceptible to mental health disorders, the world out there as well, like you said, in terms of online, in terms of social media, in terms of the classrooms, in terms of just wider society, there's a shift happening.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the services that belong to do in terms of supporting these young people?
There absolutely is a shift happening, and but we try not to get bogged down with that, right? And we see our young people coming in and using our youth services and various aspects of what we do. And we create a safe, welcoming space for them where they feel included, where they have a sense of belonging. And, you know, young people have fairly basic requirements. They want friends, they want a safe space to be. And when they come in, you can see their shoulders drop, they can relax, and they can get really into the youth groups that were there. If we look at what's going on everywhere else and how this could affect young people, to be honest, we're not in a great place at the moment. And I think everybody can really accept that. It's a very uncertain world, politically, global upset, you know, cost of living, all of those aspects, right? And we're here to protect young people as much as possible. But there is a lot going on, and we have to admit that. And as I said, those young people never had that big marriage referendum moment that they really had, you know, their heart and their equality is really there. And I think for young people, adults have to stand up and be mindful and watchful of what we're doing and how we're supporting these young people. The very loud minority, excuse me, I was going to say the silent majority, but the very, very loud minority are taking up way too much airtime, way too much space online, and they're allowed talk into this vacuum and give all of their opinions. And young people, they see this, they hear this, they see it on the news. These people are actually, you know, denying LGBTQ plus young people's basic existence. You know, a typical age, and this is research proven, a typical age of a young person coming out or realizing their sexuality is about 12. Sometimes they don't come out or tell anybody until they're 14, 15, even beyond that. I know I didn't tell anybody that I was gay until I was 19. Those 2 or 3 years, can you imagine how lonely and how vulnerable those 2 or 3 years are for that young person living in their heads, totally on their own, thinking they've got no support? They're the young people that we have to be mindful of. And I speak a lot about allyship. And, you know, allyship is a really strong word. It's an action word. It's not a passive word. Allies can be parents, can be teachers, can be youth workers, can be the person in the shop, can be your friends next to you. You need to be an active person in there and ensure that these LGBTQ plus young people feel that they have allyship. And I think we need to take a bigger step back and take a look at what's happening in the world today. Rights are extremely fragile. We're living in a very fractious democratic time at the moment. And when we use the example of repeal the 8th, that is a law that was repealed rightly. But you can easily repeal equal marriage because it was something that was written into the Constitution only 11 years ago. So, those fragile rights need to be watched and minded. And it's all the online spaces. I definitely, as a professional working in this sector, I put a lot of this on online spaces. The hostility online, on social media, algorithms designed to keep you glued to the screen all the time. There is no reason for these social media aspects or people online to tell the truth. They know that if they put the most mad things out there, that it is going to be believed because those things are going to be what's on the algorithm. And LGBTQ plus people and young people are feeling it most acutely.
And I think it's something that those actors online know what they're doing, and putting the blame on certain minoritized communities. And I know, like, the name Belong To is a very profound name.
belonged to in existence about 23 years, but it has always been called Belong To. So it belonged to LGBTQ plus Youth Ireland. So that name shows our national aspect. So we have a national reach, not only in Dublin. So we work with schools across the country, with youth groups across the country, and then we have our direct services in Dublin City Centre. Belonging is a human requirement. It's a sense. If you don't have a feeling of belonging, then you know it's very difficult to feel happy or good about yourself. And you know, one of the numbers that I use, and one of the unfortunate numbers from it being LGBTQ plus in Ireland, is that over a third of young people have reported that they don't feel a sense of belonging in school, and that's really stark and that's really sad, I think, right? And for me, you know, we're running these services to give LGBTQ plus young people who might be having a tough time in school, who might be having a tough time at home, who might be having a tough time out in public, just on the street, that it gives them that sense of home and safety and inclusion and belonging in their youth groups. And that's why we refer so much to belonging. And a word that was used recently as part of the pre-budget submission was that sense of dignity. I think every human is entitled to a sense of dignity. And I think the dignity and sense of belonging come together and are two very close words. And it's you know, you can't describe it because it is a feeling, but every human just wants that, you know, leading with kindness and have that dignity and have that sense of belonging.
And I think you guys are doing fantastic work. I know for myself, when I was a teenager, I wish I knew that Belong To existed, because it was the trenches.
Yeah.
But you guys are doing such fantastic work in terms of leading this out, being that national presence and that voice for LGBTQ young people. Thank you, Kieran O'Donovan, the CEO of Belong To, for joining on the conversation today. And if you are a young person or supporting a young LGBTQ plus person in their journey, you can engage with Belong To services at belongto.org. After the break, we'll be celebrating Brazilian Day. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, the Brazilian community and the Brazilian culture has become a vibrant part of Irish social fabric, from food, music, business, community, and even more. This week, we are celebrating Brazilian Day. It's a festival for people from all backgrounds coming together to celebrate Brazilian culture in GERT. And today, I am joined with Cibele Cardoso, who is the founder of Ireland Connection, a platform helping to bring Brazilian and Irish communities together through business, careers, culture, and inspiring stories. Welcome, Cibele.
Thank you very much for having me.
When it comes to your story and the connection that you have to Ireland, can you tell us about your journey moving from Brazil to Ireland?
Oh my God. I'm here 24 years. And the funny thing, I married a Brazilian man.
Beautiful.
And I have an Irish child. I'm just felt like at home. And Ireland is my place for 24 years. And for me is create a community together, like Brazilian and Irish people in the other cultures. It's making me very happy. I came here as a tourist, and then I fell in love because I came during July. And as you see, it's a beautiful weather, and you know, everything is green, flowers, everyone's outside walking on the beaches, everyone walk, you know, in the gardens. So then I decided to come back here to study English. And as my background is Italian, so we have the European passport. So I decided to stay in Ireland, and I never went back home.
And can you tell us about Brazilian Day and the idea behind the festival and why you guys started it?
Yes, the Brazilian community in Ireland is very important, you know, and it is estimated that approximately 58,500 Brazilians are living in Ireland at the moment. So we are very large and diverse. So in GERT was known as Little Brazil years and years ago because of the meat factories. So people come from Brazil to work in the meat factories. And then in 2024, they had their first Brazilian Day.
That's beautiful. And it's great to hear about Little Brazil in GERT. And I know there's a massive Brazilian community. And within Brazil, there's a huge diversity within that community. And the festival is a way for people to connect with the diversity of Brazil, Irish culture, to connect with Brazilian cultures, and for people to have that shared cultural understanding.
Now, I think every three people there, two is Brazilian. So, yeah, so you walk in the street, you can see, you know, it's more Brazilian than Irish people.
And I suppose when it comes to the Brazilian day, what can we expect from the day and the festival?
The festival is going to be brilliant. We're going to have samba. The ladies dancing some samba. We're going to have a caipirinha. There is more than 300 people working inside the community with the business, food, clothes. Going to have coxinhas. That's a very famous Brazilian food as well. So it's going to be all about Brazil, you know, everything like very colorful, very happy festival. And we're going to really show the identity of the Brazilian people.
And that identity is one that is very rich in culture and rich in history. In terms of how you are going to engage, is the festival mainly for Brazilian community?
This is for everyone, you know, Irish people, Spanish, African, for everyone who's in Ireland can go to enjoy the day.
And in terms of the showcasing and in terms of the community, what does community mean to you?
Community is when you get together, doesn't matter if the color, religion or anything. When you get together, you can build your own community.
And that's a great way to describe a community. It's people considering all their differences that they come together for a shared and common goal. Thank you so much, Cibele, for talking about the festival and talking about Brazilian Day.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Well, folks, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Unified, which is supported by Commission a Man. Find us on podcast on the Go Loud app and share your thoughts on Unified at unified@newstalk.com. That's a Unified with the Y-O-U. Thanks to Marisa O'Sullivan for producing and Aisha Neve on research. Join us again next week for more on Unified, Sundays at 8 p.m. on Newstalk. See you then.